Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 288 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Stephen Romer speaks with John Greening about the themes and technical preoccupations of his poetry, his life in France, his poetic influences, and the deeply personal source material that inspired one of his collections.
Stephen Romer is a critic, editor, translator from the French, and above all, a poet, of whom Elizabeth Jennings said he displays a seriousness which is seldom too weighty, and a compassion which never sinks into sentimentality. His five collections include his 1986 debut, Idols, Plato's Ladder in 1992, and Tribute in 1998, all from Oxford Poets. The Yellow Studio appeared from Carcanet in 2008 and was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. 9 years later came A Handsome, New and Selected, Set Thy Love in Order. Originally from Hertfordshire, Stephen Romer read English at Cambridge and has lived for many years in the Loire Valley, teaching at the University of Tours. He edited the Faber Anthology, 20th Century French Poems, and has translated several important French texts, notably the work of Yves Bonnefoy. Stephen, good to see you. You were saying just before we began this that you'd been busy doing more translation. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, well, this is Bonnefoy. It's his final book, which is called The Red Scarf, a very moving memory of his parents, of his relation to his father, and his father's silence, what he calls his father's silence, because his father felt he was not his mother's social equal exactly, and it's a complex psychological knot that Bonnefoy tries to unravel very late in life. And it's a moving sort of homage to both his parents.
Yes, and I could see how that would appeal to you, because you've written about your parents so much over the years.
Indeed.
That's something we'll come to, I hope. But let's stay with this the French world. I mean, do you feel equally at home in the worlds of French and English poetry, would you say?
I've never tried to write. I did try when I first moved to France in the 80s. People said, well, why didn't you write in French? And at that time I was unconditionally francophile. But it didn't work. I realised I'm a very English sort of poet, actually. I did not want to adopt. In those days, it was the days of minimalism and poets of tel quel, and the what we call the linguistic turn, very cerebral.
Yes.
I was not at home with that. I was more at home with certain lyrical poets, of whom Bonnefoy is partly, but he's pretty cerebral as well.
But certainly the French, I noticed in the Yellow Studio, your book, The Yellow Studio, there's hardly a poem without a French expression in it. So the language certainly gets into your poems, doesn't it? Because it's part of your natural world, I suppose.
It's my natural habitat.
Yes, yes.
And I've been excused that. I mean, it may look pretentious, maybe in certain poets, I hope not in mine, simply because there are expressions I use which I can't find really any, you know, they seem to be what comes first to mind. Yes. And most naturally.
Yes, yes. So tell us what it was about Herrick that appealed to you.
well, that was somewhat happenstance.
As these things often are.
Yeah, I was asked by Paul Keegan, very kindly requested that I did one of the, I think it's the Poet to Poet.
Yes.
Faber series.
It's a lovely series.
It's a lovely series. Yeah. And, there were quite a lot of the big guys had been taken. I would have done, for example, I'd love to have done Hopkins or Herbert or certain others, Coleridge and notably. But Herrick I've always loved. I mean, I wasn't a great scholar of his poems. It was a slight disorder in the dress. He was also, I was attached to him because he was an alumnus of my Cambridge College.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a sort of, again, circumstantial reason. And I really got to love him. He had very little success. He plodded on with Hesperides. He survived the Civil War and the Restoration.
And Devon.
Loathed Devon, yeah. Loathed Devonshire.
Survived Devon.
I love Devon.
Well, of course, Herrick was a love poet. I suppose you call him a love poet. And you are known very much as a love poet. And people talk of you as a love poet. But it's one of those areas of poetry that 21st century writers have struggled with. Was it Larkin used to complain all the love poems would take, when he was judging competitions, all the love poems and nature poems had been taken out before they got to him, didn't they? Was approved of. But you somehow seem to have managed to write successful love poems for the modern age, which is quite something.
And maybe the jury's out on that. one does what one can.
Yes, I mean, of course.
And I don't. And also in these days of, we may get on to talk a little bit about, certain attitudes, political correctness. To say one's a muse poet is probably being a little dangerous or
dangerous
perilous.
Territory.
But I do, I assume it, I own it, to use that awful expression. Mm. I do own it because it's what I do.
Yes, yes, one can only go where one's taken, really, with poetry. Mm. I noticed just, was it true to say most of your poems are just a page? But then one or two longer ones. The one I was going to ask you about, actually, Scene in the Round, about the lexicographer and potter Owen Watson. That's a longish poem.
Yes.
Lovely poem, struck me. And I was going to ask you about the long poem and whether you felt moved to write one, but perhaps not after what your remark.
Yes, there's that one and a long sequence called Colics for Lent.
The Colics, yes.
Which I think people have liked on the whole, which I'm delighted about.
Yes. Tell us a bit about Owen Watson and that poem, because that was a very affectionate, moving...
Yes, I will. I'm glad to. It was, as I think, I hope the poem suggests, it was completely organic. This was a dear person I met late on in life, and he was my neighbour in the Loire Valley. And he was... I Googled him and nothing comes up, which is a great shame, but there you go. He was not one to court any kind of publicity. He was a saintly man. He lived in a lovely house and he had about 18 peacocks and several goats, a herd of cats. He was a sort of St. Francis of Assisi character in some ways, although when I knew him, he got rid of the goats. Mm-hmm. And he lived in this unkempt, untreated old farmhouse, which became more and more smelly, I have to say. There would be chickens laying eggs under the lamp.
And you talk about the cat on the table. Eating from the dinner table.
Basic hygiene.
Basic hygiene.
So that literally, the poem sort of was never planned like that.
No.
But as sometimes these things happen, I visited him at certain times of year, and every visit was an occasion for me.
Yes.
And hence, springtime, summer, All Souls. And then I think maybe that goes around twice. And then, of course, he died.
And it seems quite loosely woven. Compare with some of your other poems, the very dense lyrical ones. And you've allowed yourself a kind of freedom and to bring in little quotations. And it's like a divertimento or something like that, as opposed to something symphonic.
Yes, I'd like to do more like that. That's right, because I know you love Schubert, and he listened to Schubert in the small hours when he could struggle. He was very shaky on his pins at the end.
Yes,
but he would get up and play the Abschied over and over again.
Mm. Well, I'm connected with that, and you mentioned the collects you've written. I mean, there does seem to be a kind of spirituality in the more recent pieces. Some of the earlier pieces too, the Lent poems and so on. I mean, is that a conscious shift or development, or is that something that's taken you by surprise?
My relations with spirituality are very tortuous, John, and have go back a long way. Mm. My parents are both devout, C of E.
Yeah, and that comes across in the
so clearly the ones to my father, and notably my mother.
Yes.
I use quotes from the prayer book.
Yes, yes.
Because this is also, I went to a C of E school, these things are, you can't get away from them. Mm. You can't get away from the Eucharist service, the order of words.
But it's tricky to write about as a poet, because you can end up being sentimental or soft or too hard-edged somehow, or obscure.
I had a Buddhist period. I was in India quite a lot. I think by now I'm don't ask me to explain, but I believe I'm a down-up Neoplatonist. But right. That's something I
perhaps we won't follow that. No. To tell us how you actually write. I mean, do you write a lot and then reduce, or do you inch forward gradually like Larkin used to, or do you?
Well, I've just changed, John. I had such a dry, I have to say, as often happens after the minor tombstone of a selected, new and selected. So I thought, to hell with this. I had this wonderful summer. Slightly wild summer, sort of. I was half feral in my French house. I was very much alone, very hot days. So I sat down every morning, swam in the Loire, and sat down and just. It was one of those, you know, I said an hour, I actually timed myself, one good use of the smartphone. And I said, so that became early morning, so dreams, reflections. Quotations, diary, deep memory. And some of those have become, with a bit of work, freestanding poems. But that's quite unusual for me. In the past, it's often breakdown and recuperation, and part of the recuperation is sudden and intense. You know, for Tribute, I was writing two or three a day, and that would have gone on for about 2 months. And then when you get to the end of it, it stops. It's like you cannot force. That's quite rare for me, but I knew there was one more poem I had to write. I wrote it, and the magic potion runs out. And you know when you're forcing it, so you stop.
Let's go back to the beginnings. I mean, Idols was your first book in 1986. Had you been writing a lot before that, or were those some quite early poems in there? I think of Tom Gunn, who had all these sort of undergraduate poems in his first collection.
Yes, let me just think back. I mean, I really became a poet at school. I was at boarding school. I was very lonely. That's when I first started to read Gunn. Do you remember that book that had Hughes and Gunn?
Yes, for some reason.
Yeah, well, I love Hughes, and I respect him probably more now than I did then, but I did get a little, I think maybe it was the teaching mode. Anyway, I flipped to the back of the book and read The Sense of Movement and the Sartrean poems and Raw Meat. Carnal knowledge. These are fantastic poems, and they interested me so much more.
Yeah. Well, he's a philosopher, rather, as you are, actually.
They had a bit of French philosophy. Yes. They had a bit of sort of tough existentialism. Yes.
Metaphysical quality, too.
To be honest, I moved from Brian Patton, whom I adored, to Tom Gunn, and I don't mean to patronise either of them. Yeah. Patton was very important to me. He liberated a lyric sense. And Gunn was huge. And then Yeats. I read Yeats in my first year at Cambridge, I think, and that sort of knocked everything out. Idols. Idols was quite a lot later, by which time I was in France. My poems, when I read Berryman, Catullus, or something strange, some strange mixture of ironists, and that gave me the couplet form that is in Idols, and that was a new tone. I found a new tone.
Yes, you like the couplet, don't you? And half rhyme too, creeps in a lot. Yeah. Or para rhyme. I mean, you're interested in the art of looking, and you want to make us look. But looking, but also, I mean, one of the things that I notice in your poem is how attuned you are to the music of the verse. That brings us back to Herrick again, actually. I think something you said about Herrick, about his. A poet of immense tact with an immaculate ear. But you're obviously interested in the sounds within words as well as looking. I mean, it's what you want of a poet, after all, is that they should hear the music of the language.
There's that lovely Pound quote I use for my students. Poetry is a centaur, he says. The intellectual word arranging faculties should leap and move with the musical sentient faculties. And that is a wonderful. And I think if you don't have that combination, you're compromised as a poet. I mean, the number of poets who I stop reading because they're rhythmically off is enormous. Unless the off rhythm is deliberate, which is something else.
You also, I think you're interested in satire, aren't you? And you're not an obviously very satirical poet, and yet I know you've written You wrote to me about being interested in satire at one point as a way of keeping things fresh, almost, perhaps. Is that then a direction you might take yourself in, suddenly produce a juvenile or something?
Very much so. I think, actually, it's funny you should say that, because a lot of the new pieces are fairly satirical. I don't know about you, but I listen probably too much to Radio 4. So much irritates me, so much interests me as well. Mm. Notably, the hyperbolic use of language, mm-hmm. or over-careful speech, taboos. I mean, people bang on about it all the time, so there's nothing that's not very original. I read somewhere that someone giving a course in America was beyond excited to be giving this talk. And I use that with my students. That is not only an emotional lie, it's a semantic nonsense. Mm. To be beyond excited, does that mean orgasmic? Or what does that mean? Mm. But that's you know what I mean? That's an example of... And there's so much of this language about, and it's meaningless. Mm. It's horrible. Mm. And surely poetry is about restraint. Mm. It's about bringing language back to just measure and the mot juste. And what's frightening is this was a teacher of poetry using this language to advertise. It's the language of the commodity to advertise the lyric art, and that's something very sick. Mm. And that deserves a satire.
Yes. Bring back Geoffrey Gregson.
Yes. Yes, I love... Yeah, I've been rereading Chesterton even. Yeah. Some of those guys. Very good satirists.
Do you have a favourite quotation about poetry?
Yes, I do. I do. Almost, since I've just been teaching at summer school, it's almost too much to hand. But it's Coleridge, who is really my all-time great, I think, in his life, in his thought, in his poignancy. He says the poet describes an ideal perfection. He says many things, but one of them is he combines more than usual emotion with more than usual order. And that, I think, is absolutely magnificent, because it's the more than usual. It's, yes. I was just talking about measure, but the more than usual, whatever that might mean, but I think when we know what it means, it just encapsulates what I think the best poetry has, is emotion, but... order. And both of them are more than usual.
And Coleridge is one of those poets you said you returned to. Are there other English or American poets, indeed in any language, poets you particularly return to, you know, your desert island poets?
Well, Eliot, Pound more and more, I have to say.
Pound more and more, that's interesting, because in one sense he's sort of become less and less fashionable, hasn't he?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, not maybe I didn't, when I was at Cambridge, we didn't read him.
It was still... Sometimes it's good to leave those poets till later, isn't it?
Yeah. Robert Graves, I returned to a lot.
Yes.
Geoffrey Hill is hugely important. Yeah. I know he's controversial. But Elizabeth Bishop. Berryman, I used to read, I was deeply into the Americans, but it's a slightly Lowell and Berryman. But I would go back to Berryman with pleasure, I think.
Yes, I love his music. I don't understand much of what's going on, but I love
the music. I know.
You listen to it like listen to Charles Ives or something like that. So, are there particular things, you mentioned the satire, are there other directions you want to take your poetry in, or you're just going to see what happens?
Well, I'm in a quite interesting moment, I have to say. Quite staccato, lots of dashes at the moment, which may be just trying to get things right. And not a... unafraid of anger or lyric extremity. I find the satire a release, and it can lead into something that is not satire.
Yeah. And when you're not writing, interests that feed into your poetry or that are completely different?
Music.
Music, yes, that comes out in the poetry.
But yeah, the music. A bit of gardening. Swimming, I don't know what they do really. I watch a bit of TV.
So what's the problem with poets? What to do between the poems?
Lots and lots of films.
Lots and lots of films.
And travelling. I'm travelling. I'm just off to Crete. I sort of have, I think don't we all, some of us have, you know, there's some room in the south we all want. Some bare room where I really never want to leave. But I'm always leaving.
Perhaps just finally, going back to those poems to your father in the Yellow Studio, which were very striking. There's a kind of, I think Hugo Williams commented on that, the sudden sort of directness. He'd struck a seam that was this raw and moving for the reader. How do you feel about those now, those poems? You included a few of them in your selected. I could have done with a few more, I felt, because they were very striking.
Yeah, that's kind, John. I was surprised at that. There was a very wide and appreciative response to those poems that struck me, and I wasn't quite sure. They were special and they came out of his diaries. I did have this access to something very remarkable, which in retrospect, and I did slightly debate, and they said very private diaries, but they were, it was done with love, obviously,
yes,
and they were incredible records of a very naive, innocent soul. My father was when he was a young man. But the conflicts were transparent and almost comic.
Yeah.
And there was no irony. And it was beautiful to witness. You know, when he was just after the war, he was in some military camp in Winchester, and he goes out and he meets a stranger, and he sort of has his arm round this completely unknown girl, yes, and they're watching some movie, and then they just go back. He goes back to camp, they never meet again. But it was the need for affection was huge.
Yes, that's a remarkable poem. How would he have reacted to those poems? would you have shown them to him?
That's a very good question. I hope he would have been touched. He was a modest man. I think he would have been quite touched. I hope you would have understood them in the right spirit. There's a final poem which I gave to my mother. That was a very moving occasion. It's called After 54 Years. And she's the girl on the doorstep. And because that comes from her memory as well, they went out to some show in London. And then I gave her, she was staying with me in France, she hadn't seen the diaries. I gave her the poem and I gave her the diary. My father's diary, which she had never seen, which recounts that.
Yeah.
She never mentioned it, but I think it must have been extremely moving.
It must have been,
because they separated and there was some difficulty at the end, but it would have been an extraordinary re-encounter by means of that diary.
That's when poetry comes into its own, such things, really. Stephen, it's been marvellous talking to you. Thank you so much for having me here.
It's been a huge pleasure, John. I'm honoured.
That was Stephen Romer in conversation with John Greening. You can find out more about Stephen on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 288, which was recorded by John Greening and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 289, and commencing a new season of our Location and the Writer series, Tanya Hirschman and Rick Stroud explore libraries in Manchester and London as we celebrate National Libraries Week. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.